right in her warning. Maybe Dina was insane. My vision started going hazy, and I couldn't even yell out for help. I scooped up the brace she dropped, but every part of me was screaming to not go down that road, not to even cut her arm in an attempt to free myself. That slope was far too slippery. I was already on my last warning. I wriggled wildly, forcing her to reposition her body in order to maintain her dominance. And as she did, I was finally able to put my legs to use. I slid both knees upward in one forceful thrust, causing her to jerk forward. Her hold on my neck loosened. I gasped, heaving oxygen back into my lungs. My instinct was to immediately brace myself for another attack. But it didn't come. Then I realized that my right hand, the hand that had been clutching her second brace, felt moist. In fact, my upper chest and right shoulder felt moist, too, a trail of moisture. My eyes refocusing, I scrambled to sit upright, heaving her weight off of me. Harrowing deja vu washed over me as I stared at Dina lying on the ground while choking and clutching her throat, blood spilling from her neck and pooling around her. The door shot open behind me. A scream erupted. Vera Sykes' scream.
"Oh my God! Violet killed Dina!"
"I haven't killed her," I thought to myself in a panic. "She's still alive. She just needs to get to the hospital, damn it!" But the amount of blood that was spilling from her throat, as Vera raced away shrieking for the wardens, I already knew what would happen next. Chapter 4. Footsteps pounded outside. 5 wardens spilled into the room, Vera and several other girls looming behind them. I was in a daze, still not believing what had happened. My sodden hands were trembling as 2 wardens flipped me over and pinned me against the floor. The other 3 picked up Dina and rushed her out before dragging me to my feet and pulling me into the hallway after her. My blood pulsing in my ears, everything around me was a blur. As we approached Josephine's and my room, I managed to catch a glimpse of her terrified face, but they pulled me right past her. They wouldn't bother to stop to collect my things. What use would they be to me now? We arrived at the stairwell, and my feet dragged and tripped as we wound our way down the steps. Reaching the ground floor, we moved through the workroom and the reception where Ms. Maddox was sitting. I didn't even get a chance to witness the expression on her face. I was forced forward as the wardens escorted me out of the mill. We came upon 4 more wardens here. 2 of them raced off around the side of the building, returning in 2 trucks. Dina was loaded into the back of one, myself into the other. As they slammed the doors shut behind me, I was plunged into darkness. The nightmare replaying over and over in my mind. Those few seconds before Dina's end, my knees thrusting upward, the moistness of her blood, her choking. The vehicles trundled down the long track that led to the city, but it sounded like they parted ways as they reached the end. Mine split to the right, Dina's to the left, both headed to different destinations. Very different destinations. I clutched the base of my seat as beads of sweat formed on my upper lip. The road was bumpy. My elbows and the back of my head banged against the walls, but I could hardly make an effort to hold myself still. It was as though the life had been sucked out of me already. Everything seemed pointless. I'd imagined this moment a number of times since claiming my first life. I'd imagined this journey across the bumpy outskirts of Matrix, blending into the smooth roads of the city where the labs were situated. A small part of me had always known that my anger would get the better of me again. Closing my eyes, I lost track of time. Finally, the doors opened, letting in a stream of streetlight. Hands grabbed me and pulled me out, and I found myself standing on a sidewalk, my surroundings not what I had expected them to be. I was not outside the labs, but the gates of Frenton, another detention center, the most central to the city. Then I reminded myself that this should not be surprising. It was nighttime, and lab technicians didn't work at night. Of course I would spend the night in a cell and be taken to the labs tomorrow morning. The wardens led me to the main rectangular gray building and into a reception area where they picked up a set of keys from the woman behind the desk. Then we walked along a hallway before moving down a stairwell, down, 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 until we reached what had to be the lowermost floor. We arrived at the end of the hallway lined with cells, all empty. They stopped outside the third one on our left and thrust me inside. After locking it, they strode away, leaving me to the deathly silence. I wasn't sure what to feel. Somewhere within me still blazed my perpetual flame of anger, indignation, and resentment. But deeper than that, there was more. There was abandonment. There was betrayal. There was a hollow sense of grief. For years, I'd been grasping at straws in an attempt to find meaning to my life, purpose to my days. As much as my country had been the cause of my darkest depths of depression, it had also picked me up from them. It had forced me to keep going in some direction, even if it wasn't what I would have chosen for myself. In many ways, being imprisoned had been the best thing that could have happened to me. It had taught me to stop feeling and to simply concentrate on doing. We were worked hard and weren't given time for much else. Days were comfortably numb. But now, as I sat here alone and taskless in the gloom, I didn't know how to still my mind. Almost decade-old feelings resurfaced, clawing at my chest and heart, threatening to overwhelm me. Through it all, questions broke above the surface, surging like bellows in the wilderness. What am I? Why am I here? Where did I go wrong? When and how did I become a person unworthy of living? Do I truly deserve to die? So lost was I in my mind's tempest that I didn't notice when the prison doors finally opened and the wardens stopped right in front of my cell. I gazed up at them, my vision focusing. These women were different wardens from the ones who had dropped me off here. They escorted me out of the holding cells, up the staircase, and back to the ground level. I gazed through the windows. It was still dark outside. Where are they taking me? The air had a certain feel to it, a crispness, and the crows had started cawing, indicating the imminent daybreak. Perhaps they wanted me to be first in line? We crossed the courtyard and approached a different truck than the one I'd arrived in. They locked me inside before piling into the front and starting the engine. We drove away from the compound, the quiet, neat streets lined with pastel-colored townhouses bleeding away on either side of me. I hadn't visited this part of the city for years, and we passed places I hadn't seen since I was a child. The Russell Art Gallery with its luminous mural-clad exterior, the multi-columned white stone Chrysler Theater, the pebble-dashed city library. I'd forgotten how pretty Matrix City was. The sky was clear as I looked up. The stars glistened down on me, as if taunting me. It was a beautiful morning to be my last. My heart palpitating, I tried to focus on the road. We met a crossroads, and I expected the driver to turn left down Wester Road, which was the most direct route to the labs. But she didn't. Instead, she carried on straight ahead, deeper into the center of the city. "Where are you taking me?" I couldn't help but ask. My voice sounded scratchy. It had been hours since I had last spoken. Neither of the wardens bothered to answer. The situation only became stranger when I realized we were nearing the royal quarters, the palace. I wondered if there had been new labs set up recently that I wasn't aware of. But as we continued to make a beeline toward the royal quarters, It became clear that we were heading to none other than the palace compound itself. What is happening? We glided down the final road that led to the high wall surrounding the majestic tower, which served as the queen's and her courtiers' residence. Constructed from white stone and dotted with tall windows, it loomed over 13 floors. The queen was reputed to live at the very top, occupying the highest 2 floors with her daughters. Upon our arrival at the cast iron gates, we were searched before they allowed us inside. I had never been on this side of the gates before. I had only seen the occasional photograph in the papers, and my eyes struggled to take in the incredible sight. Surrounding the tower were geometrical gardens whose lawns were almost too green, flowers almost too large and vibrant. Ornamental fountains spiked with stonefish gushed out water. Quaint stone paths wound through the grass and flora, leading up to the main entrance of the tower. Double shiny steel doors. "Why am I here?" I asked again. "Just follow," the warden holding my right arm replied. Arriving at the steel doors, the wardens knocked. The doors whined open seconds later. A chambermaid, wearing a starched white dress, appeared on the other side, as though she'd been expecting us. She led us across a luxurious lobby to a rug-clad sitting room before taking her leave. The warden sat me down on a silky padded chair, then assumed positions on either side of the door. As we waited, for what I could still only muse, the only sound to distract me was the ticking of an old oak grandfather clock in one corner of the room. Then I heard more footsteps. The doorknob twisted and clicked, and a man stepped inside the room. A man I recognized. His hair was light, almost white, blonde, and his face sported a thin goatee. His eyes were powder blue, his skin sallow. His features were altogether so fair and pale, he looked washed out. I had seen his face in the papers before. He was the only male consultant to Queen Rena's court, a scientist whose name was Alistair Jenks, if I remembered right. Born and bred in Matris, he was the son of a member of the court, and a distant relative of scientist Ianto F. Jenks, who had pioneered the methods of screening boys, the same methods that were still used today in the matriarchy. I felt a biting pang of resentment. If it weren't for Alistair and his family, Tim might have never been taken, and I might not be here now. We might still be living in the orphanage, or maybe I would have taken a job and started earning enough to become his official guardian, and for us to move into our own home. Tim might have begun an apprenticeship. Why has this man come to see me? He had entered armed with a crossbow and a shoulder bag. I eyed the bow's loaded tip. Perhaps I had been right about the wardens not wanting to wait until the main labs opened. Perhaps he was going to finish me off sooner, now. I had no idea why a man of such high status would do it personally, though. And he didn't move any closer. He strode to a chair near the clock and sat down, his weapons resting casually on his knee. Then he let out a subdued cough, clearing his throat. "I have some news for you, Ms. Bates," he said, his voice nasally and off-puttingly high-pitched. "Ms. Bradbury passed away in the hospital about an hour ago." My heart stilled. "I also have a proposal for you," he went on, "a proposal that I suspect you will not refuse." He paused for a moment, scrutinizing me. "A situation has led Her Majesty and the court to find use for a person with your type of background. We have been watching the detention facilities, waiting for the right young woman to whom we may offer this opportunity."
"Opportunity?" I managed.
"You took defense lessons with Miss Dale up until the age of 14, did you not?"
he asked, as though I hadn't spoken. I nodded.
The opportunity involves embarking on a mission which, if successfully completed, would suspend your sentence. It would allow you another chance to redeem yourself and reintegrate into society. Your previous crimes would be erased from your record, forgotten about. You would, essentially, be starting from a blank slate. He raised his almost non-existent brows. How does that sound?
My anger had given way to bewilderment, and I couldn't stop frowning at him. What mission could be so important to the court that it would cause them to erase 2 counts of woman slaughter from my record? I felt shocked that they would even consider compromising their principles in such a gross manner. What mission? I asked.
Before I explain, Alistair replied, I will warn you that after receiving this information, you will need to make an immediate decision. Take up the challenge or not. And if for some reason you decide the latter, you will receive your due injection without delay. This room will be the one that you die in. His voice lowered. Think carefully, Ms. Bates.
In spite of my bias against the scientist, I wasn't sure that there was anything to think about. This mission would offer me the chance of a new life and freedom from detention facilities. Maybe the rules in Matrix would even change someday and allow the boys in the North to see their families. Maybe I would discover happiness. Besides, however dangerous this mysterious mission could turn out to be, anything was better than death. Wasn't it?
Chapter 5. I understand the choices you have laid out, I told the scientist stiffly. My voice had dropped several tones deeper than normal. I accept the offer. Tell me the details.
Alistair's mouth twitched. I guessed that that was the closest he would get to a smile.
Very well, he said,
putting down his crossbow for the first time. He began to pace the room slowly.
Recently, we had a break-in at the court's labs. My lab, specifically. Some valuable items were taken. Specimens. After a thorough investigation, we discovered who the thief was. Unfortunately, we had a snitch in our midst. A double agent, bribed by Patris. She has been caught and reprimanded.
Put to death without a doubt.
But the damage has already been done. There is, however, one specimen that we believe is still salvageable, the most vital of all of them. It is the result of thousands of hours in experimentation and research.
Alistair paused to drag a small table in front of me. Then he placed a hand into his bag and pulled out a tightly rolled up piece of paper. He dropped it onto the table and unfurled it, revealing a map of Patris. He moved a forefinger over the paper, resting it atop the city to the far west, where the mountains were located.
Fortunately, we too have somebody on the inside, Alistair went on. An agent of our own who has infiltrated Patris's high society. He resides several miles away from King Maxon's palace and their newly renovated laboratory, which he has discovered is where the specimen is being kept. Now, this is where you come in. He wants assistance to recover it.
My stomach clenching, I leaned over the map.
What is this specimen? And what makes you so desperate to get it back?
What the specimen is, Alistair replied, is of no consequence to you. The only thing you need to know is what it looks like.
He moved again to his bag, drew out 3 photographs and planted them on the table next to the map. The pictures depicted a strange silver object in the shape of an egg. It was perched on a stark white table, supported by a transparent glass tripod.
This silver egg, Alistair said, is what you need to retrieve. It's hard to tell its size exactly from these pictures, but it's not too large to carry. Its length is about that of my briefcase. Its width a bit narrower.
He raised his bag up for me.
What would I have to do exactly to recover it?
That will be made clear soon enough, he replied, once you reach the other side of the river.
My chest constricted. The other side of the river? They're going to cart me off to Patras. Out of one prison and into another. For there was no way a self-respecting Matrian woman could describe Patras as anything other than a prison. Alistair still hadn't made it clear why they had been waiting for someone like me to come along and assist with this task. A convict who had no experience in matters of robbery or espionage. I could only assume that this mission wasn't something a lot of people would volunteer for. People with lives, family, and choices. You said that other items were stolen, I said through a dry throat. Other specimens that are pointless to reclaim. Why, then, is it not too late for this one?
The silver egg's shell is a protective casing, Alistair replied. It's designed to self-destruct if forced entry is attempted. But regrettably, that is a matter that's up for contention. Although I am in possession of its only key, the casing technology is still in the early stages of development. The inventor cannot guarantee that Patras will not find a loophole if they work long and hard enough. Hence, time is of the essence. We must retrieve the egg soon.
I glanced again at the map. But how can I go to Patras on such short notice? Wouldn't I need to go through immigration procedures or apply at their general hall for residence? I would need to wait for...
Our contact can speed up the entire process to 3 days, Alistair replied, cutting me short. He's able to pull a few strings. Getting there expediently will not be an issue. The issue for you will be staying there, and safely. Staying there in a way that you can execute the mission without hindrance. Which brings me to my next point. You must marry our contact.
What? I thought I had misheard Alistair.
You must marry him, Violet, he repeated with unmistakable enunciation.
Marry?
Yes, he replied bluntly. Marriage is the only way a Matrian woman, or any woman for that matter, can have an existence that's even semi-worth living in Patras. Our insider will sort out your papers, and when you arrive, he will marry you and take you under his wing. Then he will provide you with the details you require to execute the mission.
My voice was still trapped in my throat, but my mind raced with questions.
Who is this man? What is his occupation? What does he look like? How old is he?
Do you have a picture of him? I asked.
Yes, Alistair replied. You'll need to recognize him once you arrive at the dock.
He retrieved a photograph from the side pocket of his bag and handed it to me. I found myself staring down at a clean-shaven man with a smart, trimmed crop of black hair, thin lips, and a narrow, triangular jaw. His exact eye color was hard to make out from the photo. Somewhere between gray and blue. He looked perhaps in his mid-20s. I found him neither attractive nor repulsive, though I wasn't used to judging men in either respect. Heck, I wasn't used to judging men at all. Other than Tim, I hadn't had significant close contact with males and didn't think I'd ever need to. I sure as hell never thought I'd end up coupled with one.
His name? I rasped. That isn't required yet, Alistair replied.
I swallowed, my eyes boring into the man in the photograph, as the word swirled around and around in my head like a nightmare.
Marry.
Chapter 6. After showing me the photograph of my soon-to-be husband, Alistair was done answering questions. He took the photograph back from me, telling me that he would give it to me once again when it came time for me to leave. Then, after replacing the map and photograph in his bag and gathering up the crossbow, he led me out of the room. Two wardens were still waiting outside the door. He turned to one of them and said,
Take her to a guest room.
Then he addressed me. While preparations are underway, you should be using your time productively. I will solidify your schedule for the next 3 days and have you notified after 8 a.m.
I barely even had a chance to nod before Alistair strode away. The wardens flanked my sides and escorted me down a winding hallway till we stopped outside a door that revealed a small suite containing a single bed, a bathroom, and a kitchen area. The wardens remained outside, closing the door behind me. I moved to the bed and slumped down on the mattress. My limbs were exhausted. I should try to sleep, but I couldn't conceive of attempting it. I was still struggling to wrap my head around my meeting with Alistair. Less than an hour ago, I'd been preparing myself for certain death, and now here I was on the verge of entering a marriage, being thrust into the land of Patris. I recalled the fear in Josephine's eyes as she had spoken of the state of the patriarchy these days.
Will it really be worse than my current life?
I couldn't see how it wouldn't be. Even though I was a Matrian prisoner, I was still respected as a person in my own right, as an independent entity, as a woman. In Patris, I would be deemed incapable of being anything but some man's shadow, an accessory, a pet. No rights, no voice. I couldn't imagine anything more daunting. Even though I wore sweaty, soiled clothing, I curled up beneath the blanket and nestled my head deep into the pillow. Doubt and fear still swirled in my mind as dawn arrived sooner than I was comfortable with. I remained in bed until someone rapped against my door at 8:30 a.m. I stumbled toward the door, but it was open before I could reach it. It was Ms. Dale. Her appearance in the palace was both surprising and comforting. It felt like an age since I had last seen her, though it had only been 5 years. Her face displayed more creases than I remembered it having, and her hair was visibly graying. Her physique, however, looked as tight as ever. She was shouldering a large backpack. She cracked a small smile at me, which I couldn't help but return. "Violet," she said, moving inside. "How are you?" I shrugged. What did she expect? "Mr. Jinks sent me. He informed me that you are to embark on a confidential mission to Patris, and over the next few days, he wants me to help you brush up on some skills."
Oh.
Defense skills. What exactly does he have planned for me in Patris? We're to start now, so I guess you should get ready.
Okay. I turned away from her and moved to the bathroom.
"Also," Ms. Dale added, "I brought these for you."
She slid the backpack off her shoulders and withdrew an outfit that filled me with a sense of nostalgia. Sturdy shoes, long pants, and a top made of durable, stretchy black fabric that was almost impossible to tear. I remembered her lending me a couple of uniforms just like this during my early teenage years. I flung the clothes over my shoulders.
"Thanks. And I should also mention that Mr. Jenks' preference is for us to go to the Green to train."
"What?"
"Yep," she replied.
The Green was the dense forested region that ran across the entire northern border of both Matris and Patris. The river that separated the nations also ran through it, and that was one reason why its water was so toxic. The Green's biosphere was not deemed safe to take up residency nearby. The trees and vegetation were noxious. But it was also avoided for another reason, the wildlife that lived there.
"Why does he want us to train there?" I asked. "What's wrong with your training rooms? Don't you still have them?"
"I do," Ms. Dale replied, almost apologetic. "But Mr. Jenks said that training in the Green will make it more of a high-stress scenario. Apparently that's something you're going to have to get used to." My jaw tensed.
"The Green won't kill us," Ms. Dale went on. "We'll only be there for a few days during the daylight hours."
I felt nervous that this mission might turn out to be more dangerous than I'd thought. Though, given the stakes and the weight of the prize I'd been promised should I succeed, it would be naive of me to think it would be easy or of moderate risk. It was with a tighter throat that I entered the bathroom. I hurried to brush my teeth and take a shower. After drying myself off, I bound my hair into a tight knot atop my head before slipping into my new clothes. Ms. Dale was waiting patiently for me at the edge of the bed. Her brown eyes rose to meet mine. "Your breakfast was delivered." She pointed to the bedside table, where a tray of sandwiches had been placed along with a jug of water. I picked at and drank as much as I could stomach before returning my focus to Ms. Dale. "You ready?" she asked, cocking her head. "Yeah," I muttered, even though I felt anything but. Two wardens followed us as Ms. Dale led me out of the palace, across the gardens, and toward the main gates of the compound. Reaching them, she turned to me and said, "Wait here with the wardens. I'll fetch my truck." She returned about a minute later, driving the same old truck she'd owned 5 years ago. The wardens escorted me through the gates and piled into the back seat, sandwiching me between them, before giving Ms. Dale the go-ahead to leave. I'd been hoping that I could be alone with Ms. Dale for the next 3 days, that she would be deemed enough security. But apparently the warden still considered me too much of a threat. To what exactly, I wasn't sure. The streets were all but empty as we rode through them, which meant our journey to the green passed faster. Soon the outline of the forest and its halo of greenish mist began to creep into view. A wiry fence was all that separated the mass of trees from the countryside, because there was nobody to keep out. Nobody ventured here, just like nobody ventured into the outlands either, the desolate wilderness beyond Matrix's eastern and southern borders. Well, almost nobody. There had been cases of rebels venturing north particularly, usually mothers of marked boys who were mad enough with grief to think they could find their son if they just walked far enough. They paid no heed to the impossible size of the green. As much as Matrix's leadership made efforts to emphasize that every law and restriction instituted was for the sake of our nation's, and womankind's, long-term peace and well-being, and that it was only because of a long history of misbehavior by men that we were in this position to begin with, their assurance wasn't enough for a minority of women whose lives had been touched by the screening. Whenever I thought of my brother, it still wasn't enough for me. But I hadn't lost my mind, at least not yet. I had learned enough about the world outside from Ms. Connolly and almost every teacher I'd had in school. Nobody who tried to escape came back. Their words still haunted me now as we closed the final distance. The truck stopped in a meadow, a quarter of a mile before the green started. Ms. Dale slipped out and trudged around the vehicle, opening up the trunk. She pulled out two breathing masks and handed one to me while placing the other on herself. She addressed the wardens. "I'm sorry, I thought I had a couple more masks back there." They frowned as Ms. Dale took my arm and guided me out of the truck. Without a backward glance, she began traipsing across the field of brittle grass toward the green, pulling me along behind her. I sensed that she didn't want the wardens shadowing us either. In any case, the two women had no choice but to wait in the vehicle unless they wanted to risk getting sick. "Stay within earshot," one of the wardens called after us. "We'll do our best," Ms. Dale replied, "but I must go wherever is most conducive for training." I could feel the atmosphere intensifying the closer we drew to the green. The temperature also seemed to spike, though perhaps that was just me working up a sweat. I found myself wishing that my clothes weren't so tight, that my shoes were made of a thinner material. As the mist pervading the trees began to touch us, Ms. Dale stopped and reached into her bag. She pulled out a gun from the back compartment and two pairs of gloves from a mesh side pocket. She handed one pair to me, and we both pulled them on before continuing.
We reached a narrow door in the fence. Ms. Dale drew out a key, unlocked the door, and pushed it open. My breathing sounded labored as we stepped through it and entered the first line of trees. From the outside, I never would have guessed the mist was this thick. I could hardly see more than 10 feet in front of me. We wouldn't have much warning if an animal came charging for us. We had entered a world of low-hanging trees bursting with green sap. Moss-covered boulders, purple mushrooms, and dead wood littered the deep, moist undergrowth. Slimy vines that resembled snakes hung down from the canopy of leaves, a canopy so thick it was rare to catch a trickle of sunlight. The lighting was gloomy and altogether surreal in its greenness. Ms. Dale strode a step in front of me, her gun at the ready. Sweat trickled down my forehead behind my mask as we ventured deeper. After 30 minutes had passed, I was sure we'd traveled well out of the warden's earshot. Ms. Dale was obviously not afraid of me. Not only did she have the skills to easily overpower me, I doubted she truly believed I'd become the criminal the wardens made me out to be. She stopped abruptly. I followed her gaze straight ahead through the trees.
"Did you hear that?" she whispered. "What?"
It was a struggle to hear much other than my own harried breathing beneath this heavy mask.
"Listen closely," she said.
As I strained to hear, I realized what she had noticed. A low buzzing coming from somewhere in front of us, in the distance. A buzzing that was growing louder. My heart skipped a beat.
"Red flies?" I whispered. "Sounds like it, doesn't it?"
she murmured grimly. Ms. Dale began scanning the ground around us. She darted with me through the trees until she located a hollow trunk. She pulled out another object from her backpack, an aerosol container, and sprayed the hollow. Shiny black centipedes the length of my hair squirmed out, worming themselves into the brushwood. Then Ms. Dale pushed me inside. I cramped my body up as small as I could to make room for her to crawl in next to me. There was enough room for us to sit side by side while still having a view of the outside. The buzzing was hard to miss now. It thrummed in my ears. Ms. Dale sprayed the aerosol again, through the opening of the trunk and into the forest's atmosphere. She acted just in time. A few seconds later, a blur of brown zoomed through the undergrowth with a dense red cloud moving at an alarming speed close behind. It was a wild boar running for its life from a swarm of huge blood-colored flies. It darted out of sight, the flies maintaining their close pursuit. I could only be grateful that it was the animal they were chasing rather than us. Ms. Dale and I waited stiffly until the buzzing faded, then climbed out of the hollow and straightened. "So, Violet," Ms. Dale muttered, brushing off her pants, "now you've seen it for yourself. The flies do exist." "Yeah," I said, my throat hoarse. "Those flies were supposed to be vampiric. They attacked in swarms, and if there were enough of them, they could drain an animal or even a person to the point of death. But I was already facing certain death by execution if I failed this mission, and I trusted that Ms. Dale was trained to deal with this environment. "Let's continue," she said curtly. She handed me the aerosol can. "You carry this for now." During the next stretch of our journey, the occasional squawk of a bird made me jump, and I was introduced to yet more insects, jumper bugs and rope leeches, as well as a silver python that looked large enough to swallow me whole. But Ms. Dale deftly guided me onward. She stopped again as we arrived at the first clearing we had come across since entering the green. Taking the aerosol container from me, she roamed its perimeter and sprayed generously. It was some kind of pest repellent, evidently, but it also had a side effect of clearing the mist, making our vision a little clearer. Then she moved over to a fallen tree whose carcass was thriving with new life. She scraped away the weeds and moss from its surface, then placed her gun atop it, along with her backpack, opening the bag zipper. "Come here, Violet," she said. I approached and stood next to her as she began to empty the bag's compartment of more weapons. Guns, large and small. By the time she'd finished, her backpack had shrunk to a fraction of its previous size. My eyes met hers.
"You're going to train me to use weapons?"
I whispered. "Yes," she replied, "at the request of Mr. Jenks." My eyes trailed over the assortment of guns. Only wardens, authorized warden trainees, and professionals like Ms. Dale were allowed to handle weaponry. All of my defense training to date had consisted solely of physical contact. Now, I couldn't help but suspect that putting me into a high-stress situation wasn't the scientist's main motivation for wanting me to train in the green. He probably wanted to keep all this undercover as much as possible, and the primary appeal of this location was its isolation. "So I have just 3 days to perfect my skills?" I asked.
"I don't expect you to be perfect," Ms. Dale replied.
"But I do expect you to become proficient. Once you're in Patris, as a woman, it's highly unlikely you'll find an opportunity to train or practice. You'll be lucky to get a hold of a gun at all."
"Then what's the point of training?"
"Because it will push your comfort zone, something you need to get used to for your time in Patris. Moreover, it's what Mr. Jenks wants, so let's start." She set up a target, a rotting log, before picking up the nearest weapon to her, a handgun. She began demonstrating how to stand, aim, and fire. She hit the target dead in the center, several times over, before passing the gun to me. It felt cold and heavy in my gloved hand, and so very foreign. I spread my feet apart as she instructed, assuming a firm stance before taking my aim. I missed wildly. She made me try again and again until I got closer to the target. It took me all of 2 hours to hit the exact center.
"Good," Ms. Dale said. "Let's move on to something larger."
"Great. Larger and probably noisier." I had been on the edge the whole time, constantly glancing around the clearing, afraid that our noise would draw unwanted attention from the creatures of the green. Ms. Dale picked up the gun with the longest barrel and handed it to me after a brief explanation of the differing mechanisms between this and the previous firearm. Then she allowed me to fire. It didn't take me nearly as long to succeed in hitting the target with this. I was warming up, I supposed. She made me try out a third gun and then a fourth. By the time 3 p.m. struck, I was famished. "We'll continue practice after lunch," she said, taking my gun from me and resting it on the dead trunk along with the others. "Let's head back. There's food in the trunk." As she placed the backpack on her shoulders without the guns, I frowned.
"You're just going to leave those here?" I asked.
"Yes," she said. "They'll be here when we return. It's not like there are thieves roaming around in this place." We traipsed back the way we'd come and returned to the truck. The wardens looked thoroughly bored. Judging from the bag of dirty napkins on the floor in front of the passenger's seat, they'd found something to eat already. It was a quick lunch, and we rested for another 15 minutes before returning to the clearing for our afternoon session. We resumed where we had left off, and by the time darkness began to close in, which was as early as 6:30 due to the denseness of the green, I had worked with every single weapon Ms. Dale had brought with us. I definitely had my comfort zone pushed, but once I'd gotten the hang of the technique, it wasn't nearly as difficult as I had envisioned. Wielding a gun had started to come naturally to me. That didn't make me any less afraid of the weapons, though. Not so much of being shot as afraid of the damage I could inflict with them myself. I had a hard enough time controlling my fists. We packed everything up, headed to the truck, and journeyed back to the palace. It was late by the time I arrived in my room. We'd hit rush hour on the way back and been delayed. Ms. Dale told me she would greet me at 9 the next morning. Except for a chambermaid to bring me some dinner, nobody came to see me that night,
I'd thought that Alistair might, but perhaps he wouldn't bother until the papers were ready. Supposedly in 2 days. With my arm muscles sore and my body aching, I slept far more easily that night, though my slumber was punctuated with a nightmare involving echoing gunshots, red flies, and silver snakes. The next 2 days passed in much the same manner as the first, except that Ms. Dale varied the weapons she taught me to use. On the second day, we focused on crossbows and knives, and on the third, she brought along a sack full of more common objects, everyday items that could be turned into weapons like pens, rope, and hairpins. We met with a few more scares from the wildlife, like a pack of wolves Ms. Dale warded off with an explosion of gunshots, and a horde of venomous spiders raining from the trees. But otherwise, thanks to her experience in this environment, things went as smoothly as I could have expected them to go. I could have sworn, though, at one point, that I actually saw the shadow of a person darting through the trees, or some other kind of creature that stood tall and upright. But it vanished quickly, before I could even point it out to Ms. Dale, leading me to conclude it was the mist playing tricks on my eyes. At the end of the third day, we finished half an hour early and sat together on the log, steeling ourselves for the journey back. I sensed melancholy in my trainer, melancholy that I shared. Neither of us knew when or if we would ever see each other again. She gazed down at her gloved hands, her feet grazing the soil. "I saw that you were a disturbed girl," she said quietly, "but I never thought it would come to this." I stared at my own hands. Neither did I. "I wish I could have done something to help keep you out of trouble. I know you cared about my opinion." "I doubt there's much you could have done," I muttered. "I was on a collision course." I was beyond wanting to explain the details of the murders I'd committed to Ms. Dale, because the details didn't matter. All Matris saw was that I had claimed 2 lives. Maybe encouraging you to pursue the occupation of a warden was a mistake on my part, she said, as though she hadn't heard me. Maybe you should have been channeled into something tamer, though it would have been a waste. You are my best student. I dug my nails into the log. She was speaking as though this second lease on life I'd been granted by Alistair was hardly much better than being put down. "Ms. Dale, did Mr. Jenks really not tell you any details about the task ahead of me? Nothing at all?" My trainer hesitated for a moment, then shook her head. "He didn't give me specifics, because he said they were not required. I will say one thing, however." Shifting on the log, she twisted to face me. Her expression was serious, her brown irises glimmering in the pale evening light. "Once you reach the other side of the river, trust no one, Violet. Do you understand me?" Swallowing, I nodded. Chapter 7. After Ms. Dale returned me to my room, I was left to wait alone. I didn't know when Alistair would come for me. The papers were supposed to be ready, but it was possible they could be delayed. There was nothing I could distract myself with, no books or newspapers. I ended up taking a long shower to wash my hair free of all the gunk that had accumulated in it from the green. When I emerged in the bedroom in my bathrobe, I was surprised to find a chambermaid waiting for me. I hadn't heard her enter through the noise of the shower.
"Mr. Jenks wishes to know if you are ready for a reception," she said, her voice a tad monotone.
Yeah, I will be in a minute." She nodded and exited the room. Grabbing some fresh clothes that had been placed in the closet for me during the day, I quickly dressed and draped my hair in a towel. I moved to sit down, but my nerves would not allow it. This was it, my last night in Matris.
Wringing my hands, I paced up and down the far end of the bedroom until footsteps sounded outside the door. There came a polite yet sharp knock. "Come in," I called. The door glided open. In stepped Alistair, sporting a deep blue suit and carrying his crossbow again, followed by... I could not believe my eyes. Queen Rena. The Queen of Matris herself. I hardly knew how to react. I stared, rooted to my spot and gaping at her as she glided into the room after Alistair, who closed the door behind them. She wore a long, brown, padded-shouldered dress that clung to her tall, slender frame. Her appearance was striking, but not beautiful. Her features were too severe for that. Her face was long, the apples of her cheeks sharp. Framed by thin, slanted brows, her eyes were narrow, their color almost black, like her short bob of hair. "Your Majesty," I murmured. I should have fallen to my knees before her immediately and kissed the back of her right hand, but I couldn't physically bring myself to do it. The same stinging resentment I'd felt toward Alistair surged up in me, and I remained standing, holding her gaze. I had all but forgotten about Alistair until he dropped a gray folder onto the bed in front of me.
"Everything is lined up," he said. "Your papers have been filed with the Immigration Department. After Her Majesty and I leave you, go through this folder carefully. You'll need to memorize all details contained within it. Not only memorize, you must live them and breathe them. The photograph of our contact is also in the folder. Keep it safe. You should be ready to step out of this door at midnight tonight. I will come to collect you and drive you to the port, where you will take a late ferry to Patras."
"Okay," I said, my eyes returning to the Queen. As if mirroring me, consciously or subconsciously, she, too, had remained standing, even though there was a seat only a couple of feet behind her. Her gaze was still on me, and I suspected that it had never left. It was hard to read her expression, though. What she might be thinking. How she might be judging me. Her face was stoic, quite devoid of clues. If she disapproved of my reception of her, or rather lack of it, she wasn't showing it. Neither was Alistair. He appeared too busy with the matter at hand to think of much else.
"I must also impress upon you one more thing, Ms. Bates," Alistair plowed on. "Something that, really, should be obvious to you by now, since you seem to be a sharp girl. But it's important for me to emphasize all the same."
He stepped back from the bed and stood level with the Queen.
"Matris cannot risk a war. Our nation is founded on peace. The type of mission you are about to undertake is, admittedly, not orthodox. But sometimes drastic actions are necessary, especially since we are simply reclaiming what is ours. Even despite this fact, if King Maxon got wind that you were sent on our bidding, if you somehow caused yourself or our contact there to be outed, the consequences could be crippling, not just for you and him, but for your entire country. Patris would see it as an affront, at a time when relations are already strained. Hence, you cannot be too careful. Pay close attention to everything our man tells you."
I stared at the scientist as he finished. Even if I was successful in retrieving this mysterious egg, how would Patris not suspect that Matris was behind it? I didn't understand what would be stopping them from finding out, and then probably tracing everything back to me, the newly arrived Matris girl with magic papers. The court must have thought this through, though. They weren't stupid. I supposed things would become clearer once I reached Patris, but this truly did seem to be a tricky situation. Both Alistair and the Queen exuded an air of tension as they studied me. I found myself considering again how curious it was that they should select me for this task out of all their citizens. Couldn't they have waited for a more suitable and experienced person?
I would have thought that a man would be better suited. He could, in theory, blend in better and move about freely. They must be desperate to get the job done. The thought came with a feeling of empowerment, something I hadn't experienced in a while. If they're as desperate as me, then they need me, just as much as I need them. The queen stepped forward, closer to me, and rested her hands against the bedpost. Then she spoke for the first time. "Ms. Bates," she said, her tone deep and commanding. "You may not understand the full implications of this mission now.
I do not expect you to.
You are young. But if you keep your courage, if you pull through this with strength and determination, you will go down as a hero to your people. In spite of your past, you are still a child of Matris. And now you must fight for her. You must bear this responsibility with tenacity, with enthusiasm and passion. You have a nation behind you, Ms. Bates. During whatever trials you may face, always remember that." She let her words hang in the air before pursing her lips and giving me a firm nod. I suppose that she expected me to feel roused now, raring to go, honored at the opportunity to put my life on the line. It was my home that I was fighting for, after all. But I didn't feel anything like this. Instead, my mind was ticking. "Your Majesty," I said, bowing my head just a touch, "I understand the weight of the responsibility, and what is at stake should I fail. For this reason, I believe it would be wise on your part to give me an extra incentive, an extra personal incentive. This would ensure that, on both a conscious and subconscious level, I will be making my best effort at all times." As her brows rose, I could practically hear the question pass through her mind. What could be more personal than serving your homeland? But she didn't shoot me down. "My proposal is simple," I dared continue. "If I succeed, allow me to visit my brother, Timothy Bates, who was transported to the coal mines 8 years ago." Her nostrils flared slightly as she breathed in, her eyes moving fleetingly to Alistair's. She hadn't been expecting me to attempt to get something out of this deal above having my own life spared. She gave it a minute of thought before a smile cracked her porcelain face. "All right," she said. "If you succeed and return with the egg without creating trouble for Matris, then you shall visit your brother the very next week." It was as though a light switched on inside me. My heart swelled with joy and an anticipation I could hardly contain. When I'd taken a shot at setting my own terms, I hadn't dared to hold much hope that the queen would bite. But my suspicion had been correct. Both she and her court were as desperate as me. Tim, he would be 16 now. How would he have grown? How would he have changed? I felt jittery at the thought of seeing him again. It would be unreal, a dream. It still hadn't quite sunk in what I had just negotiated for myself. I bowed before the queen this time, and in spite of all the obstacles I knew were up ahead of me, I smiled more fully than I had in years. "I will succeed, Your Majesty." Chapter 8. I didn't have long till midnight. After the queen and the scientist took their leave, I sat cross-legged on the bed and opened the gray folder. Along with a photograph, it contained a 3-page letter of recommendation signed by a Mr. Lee Bertrand. As I continued to read through the letter, I soon realized that Lee Bertrand was the man I was to meet on the other side of the river, the man I was to marry.
He was recounting in small, neat handwriting how he and I had first met, 3 years ago during one of his visits to Matris to inspect lab equipment. How, in spite of our distance, we had maintained a relationship.